Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover Exodus 10, verses 1 through 29. We're going to call this section Locust and Darkness. Our context is this. In the previous chapter, we were going over the plagues of the boils and the
hailstones.
Boils is plague number 6.
Hailstones.
This is plague number 7. In this audio, we're going to cover plague number 8, the locust, and plague number 9, darkness over the land. Our recording quality is somewhat bad. It sounds like an English history podcaster I listened to who kept saying he was just a bloke in a shed. Well, I am now a bloke in a basement room. I am teaching the book of Revelation for 2 months at a friend's church away from home, recording on a laptop in an echoey room. Sorry about the quality, but I must continue. So now we start in Exodus chapter 10, verse 1. Actually, I'll start out with the first two verses in Exodus 10. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Go to Pharaoh, for I have hardened his heart and the heart of his servants, that I may perform these signs of mine among them, and that you may tell in the hearing of your son and of your grandson how I made a mockery of the Egyptians and how I performed my signs among them, that you may know that I am the Lord." Now, God has told Moses that God has hardened Pharaoh's heart. We've talked about that many times in previous audios. Let me just say again that God does not make Pharaoh a robot. He does not harden his heart and say, "Ha, ha, ha, I'm going to send you to hell because you hardened your heart." No, the hardening of the heart is a judicial punishment for Pharaoh's previous hardening of his heart. Pharaoh had his heart hardened by the Lord 9 times in the book of Exodus, but the other 9 times he himself hardened his heart. So we need to get that straight. I'm not going to bring that up over and over again. Now, God tells Moses that he has hardened Pharaoh's heart that, or so that, I may perform these signs of mine among them. So God has a purpose of hardening Pharaoh's heart. It looked bad for the Egyptians every time. It looked bad for the Hebrews every time that Pharaoh hardened his heart. But God had a purpose in it. And what was the purpose? He says so in Exodus 7:3. "But I will harden Pharaoh's heart that, so that, for the reason that, for the purpose that, I may multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt." If Pharaoh's heart had not been hardened, we would not know of these 10 plagues of Egypt that are still famous over 3 millennia later. We would not have seen Charlton Heston in that great movie, The Ten Commandments. So God has a purpose in all that he does. And he says, "I'm going to do all these signs." Why? "So that you may tell in the hearing of your son and your grandson how I made a mockery of the Egyptians." He's going to make the Egyptians laughingstocks for the generations of history, not merely for the Egyptians back then. Now, this idea of telling your sons and your grandsons what God has done, that's all in the Old Testament. Exodus 12, verse 26 and 27. "And when your children say to you, 'What does this rite mean to you?'" Talking about the Passover. "It is a Passover sacrifice." Exodus 13, 8. "You shall tell your son on that day, 'It is because of what the Lord did for me when I came out of Egypt.'" And the idea here is that I'm not just giving you revelation for yourself. I want you to pass it down. The application, of course, to us today is we need to pass down our Christian heritage to our descendants. Exodus 13, 14, and 15. "And it shall be when your son asks you in time to come, 'What is this?' you shall say, 'With a powerful hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt.'" Again, it's the Passover. Tell it to your children. Deuteronomy 4, 9. "Only give heed to yourself and keep your soul diligently, so that you do not forget the things which your eyes have seen, and they do not depart from your heart all the days of your life, but make them known to your sons and your grandsons." So all the things of the Exodus are to be passed down. Psalm 78, 4 through 6, "We will not conceal them from their children, but tell to the generations to come the praises of our Lord," or the generation to come, the praises of our Lord, all of his wondrous works that he has done, and his strength. "He has established a testimony of Jacob and appointed a law in Israel." Tell everybody. "Teach them to your children," verse 5, verse 6, "that the generation to come might know, even the children yet to be born, that they may arise and tell them to their children." So this idea of passing it down, this is a good verse for homeschoolers, I would say. And it worked because there's hardly anybody on the planet today that hasn't heard of what happened to Pharaoh. We go now to Exodus 10, verses 3 through 6. "Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and said to him, 'Thus says the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, how long will you refuse to humble yourself before me? Let my people go, that they may serve me.
For if you refuse to let my people go, behold, tomorrow I will bring locusts into your territory. They shall cover the surface of the land, so that no one will be able to see the land. They will also eat the rest of what has escaped, what is left to you from the hail. And they will eat every tree which sprouts for you out of the field. Then your houses shall be filled, and the houses of all your servants, and the houses of all the Egyptians, something which neither your fathers nor your grandfathers have seen from the day that they came upon the earth until this day. And he turned and went out from Pharaoh. Their houses will be filled with locusts. There are going to be so many of them. This is the eighth plague. Now, Moses tells Pharaoh a specific time when the locusts are going to come. Tomorrow, again, there's nothing supernatural about locusts per se, but a whole bunch of them showing up on command when Moses tells them to. That's a miracle. The timing is a big part of that miracle. It's in most of these miracles, most of these plagues. Now, locusts in March and April are carried by prevailing east winds that come in from the deserts east of Egypt, like the Sinai Desert, all around there, the Arabian Desert. And those east winds will bring in hordes of migratory locusts, as the NIV Study Bible says. And they come in their most immature and voracious stage. In other words, they're hungry. They're young. They're teenage locusts, and they want to eat. And so these locust plagues were greatly feared in ancient times. And as a matter of fact, a plague of locusts, a cloud of locusts coming, was a powerful symbol of divine judgment. The famous passage, of course, is in Joel 1, verses 4 through 7. What the gnawing locust has left, the swarming locust has eaten. And what the swarming locust has left, the creeping locust has eaten. Different species. And what the creeping locust has left, the stripping locust has eaten. Awake, drunkards, and weep. And wail, all you wine drinkers, on account of the sweet wine that is cut off from your mouth. Etc., etc., etc. Bad stuff, these locusts. Joel also says in chapter 2, verses 3 through 11, a fire consumes them, and behind them a flame burns. The land is like the Garden of Eden before them, but a desolate wilderness behind them, and nothing at all escapes them. Their appearance is like the appearance of horses and like war horses, so they run with a noises of chariots. They leap on the tops of mountains like the crackling of a flame of fire consuming the stubble. And you can imagine the locusts banging their wings. It would sound like fire burning stubble. Like a mighty people arrange for battle. Before them the people are in anguish, all faces turn pale. They run like mighty men. They climb the wall like soldiers, and they march in line. Nor do they deviate from their oaths. So the oncoming locusts are likened to ranks of soldiers, and I'll leave it there. Amos 7, 1 through 2, then the Lord God showed me, and behold, he was forming a locust swarm when the spring crop began to sprout. And so, another example of where locusts are used in judgment. So this is a big deal. It's not just a bunch of grasshoppers hopping in. These are horrifying, terrifying plague instruments that are coming. Moses says that these locusts will eat the rest of what has escaped. Remember, the hail had knocked off a bunch of the crops. There are some that escaped, and the locusts are going to get the rest. And when he says eat, he means eat. This is what Adam Clark says about the ability of a locust to eat. Quote, the locust has a large open mouth, and in its two jaws it has four incisive teeth, which traverse each other like scissors being calculated from their mechanism to grip or cut. In other words, those locusts are just made by God to chomp on you and to chomp on your crops. They would come in and sometimes cover, as verse 5 says. Moses says, they shall cover the surface of the land. Adam Clark says sometimes the locusts would come in to the depth of 6 to 8 inches, at least in modern times. 6 to 8 inches worth of locust. So this is a horrible plague. The plagues are sort of getting worse and worse. We go down to verse 7 in Exodus 10. Pharaoh's servant said to him, how long will this man be a snare to us? Let the men go that they may serve the Lord their God. Do you not realize that Egypt is destroyed? I think Pharaoh's servants had more sense than Pharaoh did. And it's no doubt that Pharaoh's high officials had suffered great personal loss in the plagues, and they were tired of it. But Pharaoh was a man of a hard heart. The officials of Pharaoh said, how long will this man, that's perhaps a somewhat contemptuous reference, this man, I don't know about that. That's John Gill's idea. It could be that they're scared to death of this man. They're not being contemptuous of him at all, but being afraid of him. I don't know. And notice that the officials say that God is Yahweh. They said, let the men go that they may serve the Lord their God. That Lord there is capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D, Yahweh. but they still thought of Yahweh as a local God of the Hebrews. They had no idea of Yahweh as the Lord of the whole universe. Do you not realize that Egypt is destroyed, said Pharaoh's officials? Well, destruction is always the result of human rebellion and arrogance. That's what happens to people who are arrogant. They get destroyed. I can think of a lot of political leaders who are that way. You want to be a political leader, you might better be humble. There are a few throughout history, not many, but there are a few that do quite well. But the ones that are arrogant, they're destroyed. God will take care of them. Exodus 10, verses 8 through 11, we continue. So Moses and Aaron were brought back to Pharaoh, and he said to them, go serve the Lord your God. Who are the ones that are going? Moses said, we shall go with our young and our old, with our sons and our daughters, with our flocks and our herds we shall go, for we must hold a feast to the Lord. Now you notice here Moses says, everything's going. We're not leaving anything behind. Now why was that? Because anything that they left behind, Pharaoh could use to make Moses and Aaron and the Hebrew slaves hostages. They would have to come back to get those things, whatever it would be, either their children, their flocks, their herds. And so Moses wants all of them to go, everything to go. He doesn't want Pharaoh to have any hook in him. Verse 10, Exodus 10, then he, that's Pharaoh, said to them, Moses and Aaron, thus may the Lord be with you if ever I let you and your little ones go. Take heed, for evil is in your mind. Not so. Go now, the men among you, and serve the Lord, for that is what you desire. So they were driven out from Pharaoh's presence. Now in verse 8, Pharaoh says, go, get out of here. I don't want any more locusts. Get out of here. Oh, by the way, who's going with you? Now, why did Pharaoh ask who was going? He apparently is hoping that all of the Hebrews would not go. He's apparently hoping that there would be somebody left back so he would have some leverage to suck them back into the land of Goshen and use all that free slave labor that he had gotten used to. But Moses says, all of us, everybody's going. Women, children, flocks, and herds. Everybody. Now, he could still maintain the front that he's just going to sacrifice, because in Israel's solemn feast, everyone participated, including the young. The young would participate for instructive purposes, and so he could still maintain the charade that he's just going to sacrifice. But of course, and I still don't know whether he is merely planning to sacrifice like God told him, and then God later is going to tell him to go on the Exodus, or whether Moses has in his mind from the very get-go that he's planning to skedaddle out of Egypt as soon as he gets the chance. And so he's just hoodwinking the Pharaoh here. I don't know what he's thinking, but he at least has a sensible purpose for the young to go, because they need to be instructed, and the daughters too. They need to see what's going on. And of course, they need the flocks of the herds so that they can sacrifice. And also they need the animals so they can have a feast. They got to kill the animals to eat. And so come on, Pharaoh, let us all go. Pharaoh is disgusted with the locusts, and he wants them to leave, but he just can't let them all go. Got to hang on to something. Now, why doesn't Moses just go ahead and tell Pharaoh, hey, we want to leave Egypt. Leave Egypt or the locusts are going to eat you up. Why does he keep this pretense up? Well, this is my idea. Perhaps Moses wanted to make it a little less difficult politically to let the Israelites go. If Moses said, Pharaoh, we want to leave and go back to the promised land, and Pharaoh objects to that and gets all upset, and his officials would say, well, you know, that is pretty bad. Let all that free labor go back to Canaan, maybe we just better put up with the plagues for just a little longer. We don't want to lose all the slaves. But if Moses says, we just want to go out for a few days and sacrifice and then come back, well, that's not such a difficult thing to do. So the Hebrew officials say, look, we're getting eaten up by locusts. Pharaoh, let them go. They'll come back. I think that's why Moses didn't ask for the whole enchilada when he had the chance. Now, in verse 11, Pharaoh says, hey, Moses, you've got evil in your mind. Well, the evil is from his point of view. He wasn't stupid. He knew exactly what was going on. I'm sure he was suspicious. I'm sure he suspected that Moses was getting ready to make a break for it and leave the land of Egypt completely. Now, he says something strange here in verse 10. He says, thus may the Lord be with you. That's Yahweh. May Yahweh be with you if ever I let you and your little ones go. Well, it starts out saying, like, it's a blessing. May the Lord be with you. And then he gets very nasty and says, have I ever let your little ones go? So that seems kind of strange. Here's some options. This could have been a threat. He could have been saying, this is my idea. He could have been saying, you're going to need the Lord to be with you if I let you go, because I'm coming after you. So thus, the Lord's going to be with you if I ever let you go, because I'm coming after you, and he better be with you, or otherwise I'm going to eat you up. Could be. John Gill suggests that Pharaoh is mocking Moses, and Pharaoh is saying, you can thank You can think the Lord will be with you as much as you want, but it doesn't matter, because I'm still not letting you go. May the Lord be with you. Okay, the Lord's with you, Moses. That's fine. You think God's doing all these plagues for you. That's fine, but I still ain't going to let you go. Whichever way it is, a little bit unclear there, but it's not clear that Pharaoh is fed up. In verse 11, he says, okay, you can go, but he has a condition. Only the men, not the women, not the children, not the sons, not the daughters, not the flocks. Take the men. That's not good enough. It's really ironic here that 80 years earlier, the Egyptians wanted to destroy the Hebrews when they wanted to murder the firstborn males. Now, they don't want to part with the Hebrews. They learned the Hebrews worked pretty hard. Their slave labor was valuable. Now, notice, of course, that slave labor is not necessarily valuable because it's efficient. It's not. Slave labor is inefficient because people are not working for their own account. And not only that, but despite that fact that it's inefficient, in Egypt, the Hebrews had to provide their own food, their own clothes, their own medical care, they had to adjudicate their own disputes. They had to live and not make any profit for themselves, which, of course, is different. For example, in American slavery, the slave owners had to do all that, but not in Hebrew slavery. So it was a harsh slavery. And the Egyptians thought that they could make a profit out of that, and they didn't want to let them go. But it is ironic. Now, again, as I said in verse 11, the Pharaoh said, you can let the men go, but only the men. And NIV Study Bible and John Gill says that's because Pharaoh wanted the women and children as hostages. I'm sure that's correct. The NIV Study Bible suggests that, well, only men are going to do sacrificing. Maybe he innocently or without malice thought that, hey, you don't need anybody to go but the men to sacrifice. That's what Moses originally had asked for, is sacrifice. So what's the big deal? I just let the men go sacrifice. Well, I don't think it's quite that benign. I think Pharaoh was trying to keep the men, the women, and the flocks—the women and the children and the flocks—back for hostages. Now, Moses and Aaron had not originally asked just for the men to go. In Exodus 5:1, they asked for all the people to go. And afterward, Moses and Aaron came and said to Pharaoh, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel: Let my people go, that they may celebrate a feast." So it's everyone, not just. Everyone that was asked for, Pharaoh's gradually given a little bit, but not all the way. He's going to let the men go. And then Moses was driven out of Pharaoh's presence. Pharaoh's ticked off. Now, this is what Jameson Fawcett Brown says about ancient Near Eastern customs when a suppliant is asked for something that the Pharaoh doesn't want to give him, or the king doesn't want to give him. Quote, in the East, when a person of authority and rank feels annoyed by a petition which he is unwilling to grant, he makes a signal to his attendants, who rush forward and, seizing the obnoxious suppliant by the neck, drag him out of the chamber with violent haste. Of such a character was the impassioned scene in the court of Egypt when the king had wrought himself into such a fit of uncontrollable fury as to treat ignominiously the two venerable representatives of the Hebrew people. So basically threw Moses and Aaron out on their ears, dragged them out, probably. Not a smart career move on the part of Pharaoh. We go to Exodus 10, verses 12 through 15. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the land of Egypt for the locust, that they may come on the land of Egypt and eat every plant of the land, even all that the hail is left. So Moses stretched out his staff over the land of Egypt, and the Lord directed an east wind on the land all that day and all that night. And when it was morning, the east wind brought the locust. The locusts came up over all the land of Egypt and settled in all the territory of Egypt. They were very numerous. There had never been so many locusts, nor would there be so many again. For they covered the surface of the whole land so that the land was darkened, and they ate every plant of the land and all the fruit of the trees that the hail had left. Thus nothing green was left on tree or plant of the field through all the land of Egypt. Now the east wind brought these locusts on the land of Egypt. This is a perfectly natural occurrence normally because that's where locusts came from. Notice how God uses natural phenomena to bring about his miraculous ends. Nothing wrong with that. Moses says there would never be so many locusts again in Egypt. He says that in verse 14. Now, he's either prophesying that it would never happen again. He's taking that, if we take that literally. But he could be using an hyperbole, a figure of speech. Remember on the Olivet Discourse, Jesus said there'd be a great tribulation such as had never been seen before or since. Well, Noah's flood was greater than any tribulation that Jesus talked about in the Olivet Discourse, and that was before. So obviously he's just using Hebrew hyperbole. But either way, there's a lot of locusts coming on the land. terrible plagues. We now go to verses 16 through 20 of Exodus 10. Then Pharaoh hurriedly called for Moses and Aaron, and he said, I have sinned against the Lord your God and against you. Now therefore, please forgive my sin only this once, and make supplication to the Lord your God that he would only remove this death from me. He went out from Pharaoh and made supplication. That's Moses, went out from Pharaoh and made supplication to the Lord. So the Lord shifted the wind to a very strong west wind, which is opposite of the east wind, which took up the locusts and drove them into the Red Sea. Not one locust was left in all the territory of Egypt. But the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he did not let the sons of Israel go. So Pharaoh was very penitent when the locusts were there, but when the locusts were gone, he gets hard again. He says, nah, you're not going. He was a real piece of work. When he said that he had sinned against the Lord and sinned against you, Moses, this was a foxhole confession. He had already made such a foxhole confession in Exodus 9:27. Then Pharaoh sent and called Moses and Aaron and said to them, this time I have sinned. The Lord is in the right, and I and my people are in the wrong. But he didn't let the people go. Here is what John Gill says about this confession, that when Pharaoh said he had sinned, quote, this confession did not arise from a true sense of sin as committed against God, nor indeed does he in it own Jehovah to be his God, Yahweh to be his God, only the God of Moses and Aaron or of the Israelites. But from the fright he was in and fear of punishment continued upon him to the utter ruin of him and his people, which is just a fancy way of saying that Pharaoh had a foxhole confession. Adam Clark says of this confession, forgive me this once. Adam Clark says, what a strange case, and what a series of softening and hardening, of sinning and repenting. Here's what happened. When things were bad, Pharaoh would repent. And then when Moses would lift the plague from Pharaoh, then he would get his hard heart again. Stupid, a stupid man, in my humble opinion. So Moses leaves the presence of Pharaoh in verse 18. He goes out from Pharaoh, made supplication to the Lord. Moses usually left Pharaoh's city to do his praying to stop the plagues. In the second plague, the frog plague, Exodus 8:12, so Moses and Aaron went out from Pharaoh, and Moses cried to the Lord about the frogs. So he left Pharaoh and prayed about the frogs. Plague number four, the flies, Exodus 8:29, Moses said, behold, I am going out from you, Pharaoh, and I will plead with the Lord. And then in plague number seven, the hail, Exodus 9:29, Moses said to him, to the Pharaoh, as soon as I have gone out of the city, I will stretch out my hands to the Lord. So in three of the plagues, out of the first nine here, Moses asked the Lord to let up on Pharaoh, but Moses does it privately. And of course, the question is why? This is my speculation. Maybe Moses just needed to concentrate when he prayed to the Lord. He didn't want everybody looking at him and staring at him. He wanted to keep his focus on God. The wind shifting, again, that's a perfectly natural occurrence, but the timing of it is not natural, it's supernatural. God sovereignly used natural means to accomplish his supernatural purposes. The locusts were driven into the Dead Sea. The NIV note says that the Hebrew here is Yam Suf, that is the Sea of Reeds. Now later when we get to the Exodus, when the Israelites cross the Sea of Reeds or the Red Sea, there's a big controversy there. The liberals say, oh, see there, they didn't really cross the deep Red Sea. They just crossed a little shallow Sea of Reeds, which is the extension of the Suez Canal, which is an extension of the Red Sea. Well, they just call the whole area the Red Sea, the Suez Canal, the Red Sea proper, the Suez Canal, and then the Sea of Reeds, which came at the end of the Suez Gulf, not the Suez Canal. That's modern. Let me say that again. The Red Sea itself had an extension, which was the Gulf of Suez, and then going further north of the Gulf of Suez, you had the Sea of Reeds, and so all that area was called the Red Sea. So they crossed the Red Sea, they crossed the Sea of Reeds, it's just saying the same thing. They obviously crossed in a place that was deep enough to drown them. The Sea of Reeds, if it's shallow, that didn't drown the Egyptians. And so that is just another example of liberal disrespect for the scriptures. We go now to Exodus 10, verses 21 and 22 and 23. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand toward the sky, that there may be darkness over the land of Egypt, even a darkness which may be felt. So Moses stretched out his hand toward the sky, and there was thick darkness in all the land of Egypt for 3 days. They did not see one another, nor did anyone rise from his place for 3 days. But all the sons of Israel had light in their dwellings. Now here's some options as to how this darkness occurred. The first option is the Khamsin. This is what the NIV Study Bible, John Gill and Jameson Fawcett and Brown suggest. This is a blinding sandstorm in the area that blows in from the desert in the early spring. Now, here's some arguments in favor of this idea that it was the Khamsin, or the Khamsin, I'm not sure how to pronounce that, that caused this. First of all, the timing. This was in the early spring. Remember, the Passover is coming up here shortly, and that's the early spring. And that's when the Khamsin normally occurs. Notice the darkness was so thick that it would be felt, verse 20. You can feel sand. You can feel sand on your skin in the darkness. Also notice that no one could leave their house for 3 days. It said, nor did anyone rise from his place for 3 days. Now, ordinary darkness, people could probably leave their homes, just light a candle, go outside. But they didn't go out of their houses for 3 days, which suggests that they couldn't go out because they couldn't breathe because it was a sandstorm. And also, a sandstorm, it can easily discriminate between Egyptians and Hebrews. It just blows in the south and the Egypt proper, but in the northeastern land of Goshen where the Hebrews were, the sandstorm wouldn't blow. So that's pretty reasonable. Here's another option suggested by John Gill and Jameson Fawcett Brown, that the darkness was caused by a thick, clammy fog. Fog can be felt. This darkness can be felt, as I said, verse 20. And also, you can't go out in a fog, because a lamp will not dispel the darkness of a fog. And also, a fog can discriminate between Egyptians and Israelites. So it could be a fog or a sandstorm. I prefer the sandstorm idea better, but I can't prove it one way or the other. At any rate, whatever it was, this darkness was an insult to the Egyptian sun god. Now, you know, if you've studied Egypt long enough, how they love the sun. Ra, ra, ra. The sun god Ra. Sometimes he's pronounced R-E, Re, Re. I don't know how to pronounce him, but Ra is the sun god, one of the chief deities of the Egyptians. And once again, the plague insults an Egyptian god. That darkness was a great symbol for the spiritual state the Egyptians were in, as Adam Clark says. John Gill has a florid poetic quote about the Egyptians in their darkness, no one being able to rise for 3 days. Gill says this, quote, supposing the course of nature was changed and all things going to a disillusion, their consciences filled with horror and terror and black despair, strange and terrible phantoms and apparitions presented to their minds. Well, I suppose that describes how they felt. We go now to Exodus 10, verses 24 through 26. Then Pharaoh called to Moses and said, go serve the Lord, only let your flocks and your herds be detained. Even your little ones may go with you. But Moses said, you must also let us have sacrifices and burnt offerings, that we may sacrifice them to the Lord our God. Therefore our livestock too shall go with us. Not a hoof shall be left behind, for we shall take some of them to serve the Lord our God. And until we arrive there, we ourselves do not know with what we shall serve the Lord. Now, Pharaoh was bound and determined to hold on everything he could. Notice how God broke him down in stages. The first stage was absolute prohibition. Pharaoh says, absolutely, Moses, you are not going anywhere. The second stage was, okay, Moses, I'll let you go, but you're going to have to not go very far. You got to stay close by. The third stage was, well, okay, I'll let you go further away, all the way to Mount Sinai. But only the men are going to go, not the women and the children and the sons and the daughters and the flocks and the herds. And finally, he said, okay, we'll let the men and the women and the children go, but we're going to keep the cattle back. You can't take the cattle with you. And finally, everybody goes by the time of the 10th plague, which we haven't got to yet, the killing of the firstborn, not the murder, but the killing of the firstborn. Let's see this absolute prohibition. The first plague, when Nile's water was turned to blood, Pharaoh said in Exodus 7:22-23, but the magicians of Egypt did the same by the secret art, so Pharaoh's heart remained hardened. He would not listen. Pharaoh turned and went into his house. He did not even take this to heart. Ah, I don't care. Get out of here, Moses. Second plague of the frog, same attitude. But when Pharaoh saw that there was a respite, he hardened his heart and would not listen to them as the Lord had said. Third plague, the gnats come, Exodus 8, verse 19. Then the magician said to Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. But Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he would not listen to them, as the Lord had said. He doesn't even mention about letting anybody go. The fifth plague was when the livestock were all killed, Exodus 9:7. And Pharaoh sent, and behold, not one of the livestock of Israel was dead. But the heart of Pharaoh was hardened, and he did not let the people go. Just boom, you're not going. Sixth plague, the boils. Exodus 9:12, but the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, and he did not listen to them, as the Lord had spoken to Moses. So, we got five plagues here. I skipped the fourth plague as I was going through here, where Pharaoh just didn't say. But the fourth plague was pretty bad. That was the flies. And Pharaoh relented a little bit there. Pharaoh called Moses and Aaron and said, go sacrifice to your God within the land. In other words, sacrificing Goshen. I'll let you sacrifice, but don't leave Goshen. That was after the fourth plague, the flies. We get up to the seventh plague, the hail, and Pharaoh says this. Pharaoh sent and called Moses and Aaron and said to them, this time I have sinned, the Lord is in the right, I and my people are in the wrong. Plead with the Lord, for there has been enough of God's thunder and hail. I will let you go, and you shall stay no longer. And I'm assuming he's letting the people go, just like he said in the fourth plague, which is, I will let you go, but only, I'll let you sacrifice, but only within the land of Goshen. You can't go all the way to Horeb or Sinai. Now in the eighth plague, Pharaoh says, okay, I'll let you go. I'll let you go all the way to Mount Sinai, but only the men, not the women, not the children, and not the livestock. Exodus 8, 9 through 11. Moses said, we will go with our young and our old. We will go with our sons and daughters and with our flocks and herds, for we must hold a feast to the Lord. But Pharaoh said to them, the Lord, to Moses and Aaron, the Lord be with you. If ever I let you and your little ones go, look, you have some evil purpose in mind. No, go the men among you. The men among you. So you see, Moses has said, no, we're going to take our sons, our daughters, our flocks, and our herds. And Pharaoh says, no, the men among you, you go and serve the Lord. Now we get down here to the ninth plague, the darkness. Pharaoh says, the men, the women, and the children go, okay, Moses, okay, men, women, and children, but not the cattle. Exodus 10:24. Pharaoh called Moses and said, go serve the Lord. Your little ones also may go with you. Only let your flocks and your herds remain behind. Again, Pharaoh is looking for some leverage. He wants to keep the Hebrews hostage in some way so that they have to come back to the land of Egypt, the land of Goshen. If they had to come back for their flocks and their herds, they could do that. But how are they going to have a feast and sacrifice without flocks and herds? And Pharaoh's request, even on Moses, Pharaoh's restrictions, even upon Moses' moderate request just to go sacrifice, not to leave the land, but just to go sacrifice, even on that assumption that it was a modest request to sacrifice, it doesn't make any sense not to let them have their flocks and their herds. So Pharaoh's still acting like a horse's rear end. Now again, the perennial question here comes up is, why did Moses go through with this charade? Surely Pharaoh knew that the Israelites weren't planning on returning, and so he kept asking for something of the Israelites to remain behind to make the Israelites return. Well, why didn't Moses just say, no, Pharaoh, we want to all go? Well, here's some options. Option one is Moses still didn't know that God's ultimate intention was to remove the Israelites by means of the Exodus, and Moses just thought that God wanted Moses to go to the wilderness to sacrifice. Option number two is Moses knew that God wanted Moses to lead the people, lead the Hebrew slaves out of Egypt completely. Moses knew that, but he wanted to make it as easy as possible on Pharaoh to accede to Moses' request by asking for something a little bit more moderate, so his advisors wouldn't get all the panties in a wad and get all upset and say, well, Pharaoh, you know, the plagues are real bad. They're awful. But man, look at all that slave labor we're going to lose if we just let them go, and how it's going to make us lose face, and we just going to look like a bunch of chumps. I suspect that's why Moses kept up the charade, trying to make it easier on Pharaoh and his advisors for them to save face and let them go. And they would need these animals not just to have sacrifices, but they had to have food and milk as they went to the desert to sacrifice. They had 600,000 men. How are you going to feed 600,000 men in the desert, plus the women and children that went with them? Now, Moses says when the children of Israel will arrive in the desert, at verse 26, Moses said, we ourselves do not know with what we shall serve the Lord. And that's probably true. I'm sure that's true, because what sacrifices were required were not spelled out into the law, which had not been given yet several years later, or several months later, probably, on the Exodus. But they didn't know yet, so Moses is saying, we've got to take all our animals, and then God's going to tell us what we need to sacrifice. We go now to Exodus 10, verses 27 through 29. But the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he was not willing to let them go. Then Pharaoh said to him, get away from me, said to Moses. Get away from me. Beware, do not see my face again, for in the day you see my face, you shall die. Moses said, you are right. I shall never see your face again. Again, the hardening of Pharaoh's heart is a punishment for his obstinacy. Now, isn't this cheeky of Pharaoh? You're going to die, Moses. Here, Moses has already basically wiped out the land of Egypt, destroyed Egypt, and now Pharaoh's going to threaten Moses with death? How stupid. How idiotic. And ironically, it was Pharaoh who died in the Red Sea. It wasn't Moses that died. So that was an empty boast. Now, when Moses says, "You are right, I shall never see your face again," there's two ways we can take that. We can take it conditionally, as John Gill says. So Moses will be saying, "I won't see you again, Pharaoh, unless you summon me, Pharaoh. I'm not requesting to see you again." In other words, I'm never going to see your face again, right, Pharaoh, because I'm never going to ask to see in your presence again. So you forget it. I'm not going to come see you again. I think that's the right answer. The reason why I don't think it's unconditional, an unconditional statement, "I'll never see your face again," is because we have some scriptures in Exodus 11 and 12, which make it sound like Moses did see Pharaoh's face again. Exodus 11, 8. "All these your servants will come down to me and themselves before me, saying, 'Go out, you and all the people who follow you,' and after that I will go out." And he went out from Pharaoh in hot anger. Well, that sounds like Moses did see Pharaoh again. Gill and Clark try to salvage that by saying, well, that could have occurred right here at this instant where we're talking about here in Exodus 10, verses 20 and 29, that Moses and Aaron left in hot anger after they said, "I'm never going to see you again, Pharaoh." Well, that's possible. How about Exodus 12, 31? "Then he," the Pharaoh, "called for Moses and Aaron at night and said, 'Rise up, get out from among my people.'" This is when the firstborn plague hit. "Rise up, get out from the death of the firstborn plague hit. 'Rise up, get out from among my people, both you and the sons of Israel, and go worship the Lord as you have said.'" Well, that sounds like Moses and Aaron saw Pharaoh then. Well, to save that one, Pharaoh could have sent messengers to Moses and Aaron, as Clark said. Well, maybe so, but I think what Moses is saying here, "I'm not going to see your face again. I'm not going to ask to see your face again, Pharaoh." In this situation, Jameson Fawcett Brown say, quote, "The calm firmness of Moses provoked the tyrant, frantic with disappointment and rage, with offended and desperate malice. He ordered him from his presence and forbade him ever to return." And on that unhappy, sad note, we have finished with Exodus 10. In our next audio, we'll take up Exodus 11, and we will look at the final plague being threatened by God. God threatens a final plague on Egypt, which of course would be the death of the firstborn. It's a short chapter, just 10 verses. We'll see you next audio for that one, and I hope you enjoyed this episode.